This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of writers here from thetrumpet.com, eager and ready to discuss the important events of the week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be here.
It has been said that history repeats itself. There's nothing new under the sun. But in supposedly enlightened academic circles, there's a common view that history actually moves in a straight line, just like Darwin's theory of evolution. Things just keep getting better and better, more sophisticated, more highly evolved. But the truth is, you have to ignore an awful lot of history and have a pretty distorted view of the present in order to believe that. History does go in cycles. The past becomes prophecy because human beings keep falling into the same patterns time and again, governed by our human nature. If you're watching events in this world, you know these are increasingly dangerous times, and many analysts have been noting that conditions today are looking more and more like those that led up to the greatest war in human history, World War II. A report out this week draws attention to some of these conditions, and we're going to begin the program today by talking about this. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Good afternoon. Yeah, now I like this article. Usually on this program, we kind of take a deeper dive at very specific news events happening in specific countries. And what this article does is kind of take an opposite approach. It steps right back from the world and just takes a very broad global overview, focusing especially on Eurasia. This article from Geopolitical Futures, it starts by saying Eurasia has always been a turbulent place, but over the last few years, its turbulence has taken on a new and more ominous form. Various parts of Eurasia have destabilized, and the destabilized areas are beginning to interact. The last time we saw this happen was prior to World War II. This isn't to say that we are necessarily heading towards a Eurasian war, but it does mean we've entered a new historical phase, and that new phase carries with it dramatically increasing risks. So it's really a very bold warning from this that comes out of this high-level view of world events.
So let's talk about some of the specific circumstances that they're pointing to as looking back at that World War II history.
Right. So if you look at the World War II, and really you can take World War I and World War II as almost one conflict, as this article does, with just a pause in the middle. Now, in the run-up to those major conflicts, you had an established power system, you know, Pax Britannica. Britain was the predominant power and the kind of the guardian of the international order. And then you had other rising powers that were coming up to challenge that. You had the United States, but the ones that were most intent on challenging that were Germany and Japan. Related to that, and especially prior to World War II, you had a major financial crisis, and that was really feeding and worsening the various different crises. And so you had some crises that could have been viewed regionally, and then in World War II, they all ended up overlapping and escalating into a war that engulfed the whole world. And so this article is raising the parallels today. So today, we have rising nations challenging the world power system. You have China rising. You have Russia trying to reestablish the kind of the post-war order. You have a couple of different strands of radical Islam within the Middle East that are trying to establish a caliphate at the heart of Eurasia, and that's really spreading instability. Then these crises are starting to feed each other. The European crisis, the Russian rise of Russia intersects with the Middle East. It intersects with Europe. The crisis within the Middle East is affecting Europe with refugees. And then you have the financial crisis. And again, that's feeding everything. The financial crisis is worsening. is affecting what's going on in the Middle East. It's also pushing now China, this rising power, to become more authoritarian, to become more dictatorial, because it's got to hold the nation together in the face of potentially high unemployment and social unrest. So all these crises that you see that we could look at on them by themselves are starting to interact, and then they're starting to bounce off each other and build off each other, and there's the real risk of a dangerous escalation, which is what this article is drawing attention to.
And in the face of all of those mounting crises that are bouncing against one another, you also have this reticence on the part of the predominant power in the world to get involved, similar to what you saw before World War II.
Absolutely. And that is one of the big things that this article draws attention to. Unfortunately, that was one of the major sections I wasn't able to fit in the Trumpet Weekly. This was quite a long article and we had to condense it down a lot. But it does note that the United States is returning to its pre-World War II posture, where the United States has really decided, you know, this is getting pretty crazy. Either the United States is unwilling or unable to deal with all of these fires. And so the United States has taken a step back and is starting to take the view, okay, well, we'll just intervene where we're forced to. And if we're not forced to, we'll just kind of let those fires go on burning, which was exactly the case with the run-up to World War II. And, you know, a lot of those powers in the run-up to World War, I mean, Japan attacked America because it saw America as aloof and not fundamentally powerful.
Yeah, that is a really good point, because obviously Winston Churchill always very famously referred to World War II as the unnecessary war, just bringing up the fact that if America and Britain would have dealt with those problems in the late 20s, early 30s, things would have never gotten out of hand as much as they did, because you did have this, it was like kind of like a passing of the baton, I think, where for all the 19th century, you had the Pax Britannica, where Britain was the world's peacekeeper, and then the latter half of the 20th century we had the Pax Americana, where America was the world's peacekeeper. And just for those few decades between World War I and World War II, in the middle of those two peaceable times, you had this like this switchover to where neither nation was nearly as dedicated to trying to keep world peace as they were before, and we ended up with the two worst world wars in history.
This this point that this article makes about just how much there was this effort to step into the breach and redefine the global system. We've talked about that quite a lot, just how much what we see today is the world trying to define itself in the absence of American leadership. And these nations that you're mentioning, China, Russia in particular, and we would presume at some point Europe, these are the kinds of questions that European nations are wrestling with. But what do we do? How can we take advantage of this moment and step in and, you know, assert ourselves on the world scene? Same type of scenario that you saw playing out prior to World War II.
Right. And that's one of the other great points that this article makes is, you know, fine, a lot of these crises could seem like they might be manageable right now. They don't necessarily seem vastly extreme, but this article says the single most dangerous factor is there are no apparent arresters. There's no clear forces that can stop the fighting in the Middle East, the EU internal crisis, the Russian economic and strategic crisis, or the Chinese political, social, and economic crises. Without arresters, these crises will continue and intensify. There doesn't seem to be a force to contain it. So the United States has stepped back. I think there's some debate even at this stage whether the United States would even be able to contain all these different crises if they put their minds to it. They probably could do a lot more than they're doing right now. But there's nothing to stop these crises building out of control. And it's not just one. There's, as it listed, five or six of them there. Who's going to stop the rise of China? Who's going to stop China becoming more authoritarian? Who's going to bring peace to the Middle East? These are solutions, or these are problems that no one has any kind of solutions for. And they're spreading. In this article, it draws attention to one of the things we've been talking about over the past couple of weeks, with this potential now for instability in the Stans in Central Asia, and just how these crises are just spreading in intensity, but also then spreading geographically. And you know, once you start tracing those trends out as they continue, it is looking very dangerous.
Well, very interesting overview. We appreciate that. Definitely an article that is worth reading. And we have excerpts of it in our weekly news report that we produced this week, the Trumpet Weekly. This is something that we produce every week with an overview of the most important events from around the world. And we just encourage you to go onto thetrumpet.com and receive a free subscription to that weekly news report. The cover story on this week's edition is Ethiopia on the Brink. It was written by Trumpet.com writer Callum Wood. And this relates to a part of the world that a lot of people don't pay much attention to, but it actually factors into biblical prophecy in a significant way. So for this story, we're going to go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
Yeah, I'm really happy that Callum wrote on this. It's something, as you said, that is in the middle of Africa, and sometimes things in Africa don't get the world's attention. And yet, Ethiopia is a very important country. It's the second largest nation in Africa. It's got 100 million people. It's the third largest military in Africa as well. And it has been a pretty strong ally of the United States for quite some time, providing stability around the Horn of Africa, a really important trade route, maritime trade route as well. So what happened? Things that happen when Ethiopia is destabilized like it is right now, it can have ramifications that greatly outweigh just its geographic region or Ethiopia itself. So Callum wrote about the past 3 months and the unrest that we're seeing inside Ethiopia. Ethiopia today is made up of about, I think it's about 9 districts, and they're mainly very different ethnicities. And the 3 main districts with the largest populations are experiencing riots and borderline revolt against the government. The government is mainly ruled by the Tigris people, and they are just up the main body of them, or where most of that ethnicity is in the very north of Ethiopia, bordering on Eritrea. And while they only make up 6% of the population, every single seat in the government belongs to this ethnic group. The whole military belongs to this ethnic group as well. And the rest of the nation, especially the 3 larger ethnic groups, have had enough of being ruled over by the dictates of such a minority.
So there's often a lot of unrest in a lot of African nations. What difference does it make who rules Ethiopia, Brent?
Well, Ethiopia, as I was saying before, it is a very important nation just because its geographic place around the Horn of Africa. And it is important to look at this uprising as being different to many others. It's similar to some others in the past. Ethiopia has seen about 3 different types of governments going back to the emperor days of Mr. Selassie. And then after that, he was ousted by basically a bunch of the military coup, who then ruled through the 70s and all the way up to the 90s. And they were backed by the Russians. Then in 1991, we had a democratically elected government finally get in, and yet they've taken over to the point that we see today. And what's interesting about all of those times that there was an overthrow of the Ethiopian government, there were a number of factors that contributed to that. One, there was a huge famine that directly preceded it, and that is something that we're seeing again today. A huge famine is currently underway right now. There's about 15 million people that are threatened by famine right now. 80% of the country is living in poverty in Ethiopia. And they said that, and the other thing that was necessary is that a foreign power no longer supported the current government. The foreign power kind of withdrew. Now, Geopolitical Futures, they wrote about on this about a week before Callum did, and they had the opinion that the government is not going to fall. And it's interesting. I'd just like to read a quote because I disagree with them. I disagree that Ethiopia won't be changed going forward. They said that famine tends to be a tipping point for the people's tolerance against the government. Then protest movements will emerge as a response to the oppressive regime, which there is. But then they say governments do not last in the absence of a strong support from an extra-regional power. And then they continue to say that they say, though some of the necessary elements to dispose this government exist, not all the necessary factors are present. Most importantly, the country enjoys the backing of the world's great power, the United States, and Washington has a strong interest in ensuring Ethiopia does not descend into chaos. So their whole argument, they set it up saying all the conditions are ripe for Ethiopia to fall, this government to fall, and yet the one thing that they have going for them is the United States is supporting the government, or has done historically. And yet what we've seen time and time again over the past 5 years all over the world is that governments that the United States has relied upon to get their support have faltered, have fallen. So I think that's what we really need to make a distinction there, to see that Ethiopia could fall. Now, of course, if it does fall, who is going to benefit most?
Right.
And that's where it becomes really interesting prophetically.
Anytime you see this kind of instability in a nation that is geographically this significant and in this region and looked at in the light of a lot of other events that are happening here, and Callum brings attention to this in his article, who do we see stepping into the breach but Iran?
Right. If we go south of Ethiopia, you've got Somalia, the Somalian government. They just cut off ties with Iran because Iran was meddling too much in their internal affairs. Eritrea, just to the north of Ethiopia, reports came out that they were actually training the Houthi who are fighting in Yemen. And then if we go up into Sudan as well, the Quds force is operating in southern Sudan. All this area surrounding Ethiopia has Iranian interference in it because of their desire, as we've talked about on this program, to control the sea lane through the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden right there. And really right in the center of all those coastal regions is Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And that if they were to control Ethiopia, this wouldn't be an Iran that has a slight influence in these other nations around Ethiopia. This would be an Iran that would be much more bold and much more able to influence those nations around. I'm sure the Europeans will have something to say about that as well if that does happen.
Well, we're going to talk about Libya in the second half, but really this does point to an article that our editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote called Libya and Ethiopia Reveal Iran's Military Strategy. You can find that on thetrumpet.com, but definitely go check out the cover story of this week's edition of The Trumpet Weekly and read Callum Wood's article, Ethiopia on the Brink. Thank you for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. If you've been listening to Stephen Flurry and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, you know he's been talking quite a lot about a growing list of provocations by other nations against the United States. And we could say perhaps the biggest recent large-scale provocation came from North Korea. To talk about what happened and how the U.S. responded to it, we're going to turn now to Jeremiah.
Yeah, on September 9th, North Korea detonated its fifth nuclear weapon. And like the previous four, this nuclear test was illegal. It was a clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Also, like the previous four tests, it demonstrates the ineffectiveness and the danger of nuclear deals that the U.S. seems eager to make with belligerent nations. But there's a key part of this fifth, most recent test that is unlike the previous four that the North has conducted, and that is that the last weapon was miniaturized. Miniaturization is a key milestone for any aspiring nuclear power to reach. It basically means that instead of a huge bomb that could never be detonated anywhere except in the massive bunker where it was built, that you suddenly have a warhead small enough to mount onto a ballistic rocket and fire it wherever you want it to explode. So that marks a major step forward in North Korea's nuclear program. Miniaturized bombs can actually be weaponized in a way that they're, you know, previous bombs couldn't have been. And now the fear is that the next test could see the North launch a live miniaturized nuclear weapon on one of their missiles, which some analysts say that could trigger a war there with the South. This latest test is also really significant because of the size of the bomb. If you go back to the North's very first detonation in 2006, it was a little bit under 1 kiloton. And then their next one, 3 years later, I think it was a 2-kiloton weapon. And then their last two tests in 2013 and January of this year were both around 6 kilotons. But this most recent bomb was 10 kilotons. So it's quite an increase. Not only is it miniaturized enough to go on a missile, but it has a considerably higher strike power, close to as much as the little boy that the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima back in 1945. So this was a really dangerous escalation, I think.
Yeah, it's a good point that you brought up at the beginning, what you said about the fact that this is taking place in the context of the nuclear deal that we made with Iran and the efforts that the United States and other nations are making to try to secure nuclear weapons with some states. And of course, there are some who contend that Iran and North Korea actually have a high degree of collusion, and some of these tests might actually be tied to Iran, if not done on Iran's behalf. It definitely is very dangerous what's happening here. How is the United States responding? We're going to talk about that next, and I'll just turn it over to Andrew.
Yes, well, like I said, it is amazing just the lack of response here, especially with how much we've talked with Iran. They're like, well, their nuclear program's peaceful, and if it were to ever not become peaceful, we'd clamp down on it. But yet we've got a very similar thing here with North Korea, where we've made deals with them in the 90s to let them develop nuclear technology. Now they've made up to 5 bombs, and we've become mostly just numb to it. It doesn't get much of a response. I think the only thing America's done so far is on Tuesday, we had 2 U.S. fighter jets fly over top North Korea, just kind of supposed to, I guess, be a sign that we're still willing to fly jets close to your country, which the North Korean media has mocked to no end. Just how little of a response that was. Now, President Obama has also called the leaders of both Japan and South Korea, saying that there will be consequences, like maybe more sanctions, even though sanctions have really done nothing so far. And in a very dictatorial regime like North Korea, even if we sanctioned them to the point where there was only food enough for one person, that one person who got the food would be the guy who was making the decisions about whether to continue the nuclear program or not.
Right.
So the economic sanctions and or food sanction was what we do. The only people they're hurting are the people who have no say in it. Now, China could do some with sanctions. They refuse to because they give them a lot of the oil and military money that they're using. So that's what most analysts have said. They said if the United States has decided to take a military option to this off the table, which is a pretty safe solution, it seems like United States is not going to be willing to get military involved in North Korea. A peaceful solution's really hard to come across without Chinese cooperation. They're the ones that are giving them like 90% of their oil revenue, and their only official military ally is China. And China's refused to do much cooperation here, at least not until the United States signs a peace treaty with North Korea, officially ending the Korean War. China would like the U.S. to do that. The United States doesn't want to just sign a unilateral peace treaty if they get nothing in return for it, even though that's basically what they did in Cuba and Iran. So far, we don't want to sign a peace treaty where we get nothing in return with North Korea.
So China, this is something that we've monitored for quite some time. They are really the benefactors of North Korea in allowing this regime to continue to do this, undertake this kind of behavior. Jeremiah, what's in it for China?
Well, there is some evidence that China's patience is thinning with North Korea in some ways. They often castigate the regime for these tests, but it always stops short of rhetoric. You know, they never actually support sanctions or anything like that. I think China likes having a buffer between its mainland and then South Korea, where you've got thousands of U.S. troops. China also really doesn't want a collapse of the North Korean regime because it would see a flood of North Korean refugees basically flood into the Chinese mainland, which would put quite a strain on their economy.
Well, a lot going on there, and I think really viewed in context of what Stephen Fleury has been talking about on his program, it's probably the strongest individual case showing evidence of just how weak the United States has become and how much these foreign powers are flaunting that and stepping into that void, and really without any concern for what kind of consequences they may face. We appreciate that, gentlemen. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about dangerous developments in Libya, a cardinal who is warning that Islam is taking over Europe, how the Philippines could switch allegiance from the United States, and how some people say talking about religious liberty is homophobic and racist. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This past week was the anniversary of 9/11. Of course, many people around the world remembered the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center back in 2001, 15 years ago. But that date was also the anniversary of the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans just 4 years ago. It was a shocking incident that revealed just how far the nation of Libya had fallen into chaos since the U.S. helped depose Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi. Well, things in that country haven't gotten any better in the last 4 years, and evidence is that they're actually taking a turn for the worse. And for this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and hear from Brent Noctegal.
So a lot of what we've talked about concerning Libya in the past, and especially what the world's been focusing on, is the fight against the Islamic State inside Libya. And that fight, while it continues, probably isn't the biggest worry for the international community. It is more the fight between the two rivaling governments of East Libya and Western Libya. And just this past week, there was a pretty important move that was made by the general of the army that supports the Eastern government.
The Eastern government, just tell us about that. This is the UN-backed...
No, the Eastern government is actually the democratically elected government that was internationally approved until the creation of the Government of National Accord, which is the UN-backed government in Western Libya based out of Tripoli. So what happened was these oil terminals, they're obviously extremely important, located in the Mediterranean Sea. This is the main source of income for Libya, whoever rules it. They need to maintain control over these oil terminals because that's how their oil goes out to sea. And they were being controlled with a militia leader that was aligned with the Government of National Accord. The Government of National Accord is the hope of the West going forward in Libya. That is a government that was set up or midwifed by the UN, by Europeans, by the United States to hopefully find a partner to work with, to stabilize Libya going forward, to stop migrants going north across into the into Europe, to get rid of the Islamic State. The world needed to find a partner to work with, and they chose this Government of National Accord. And yet, the Government of National Accord does not, even though it sounds nice, does not represent the Libyan people entirely right now. There, ever since the creation of this government back at the start of the year, the government based out of Tobruk, which is the legislative body that didn't want to see all their power go over to this other government, they have refused to submit to the Western-backed government. The thing that the Western-backed government had going for it, one of the things, was the fact that they controlled the oil terminals. So that means that they were able to get some of the revenue from oil sales, though they're severely diminished and have been since Muammar Gaddafi was ousted. And yet this past week, the news of the week was that the general that leads the Eastern Army actually took over these three oil terminals on the Mediterranean coastline there in northern Libya.
So the government of National Accord had, at least they had the resources on their side. Now that they've lost these, it looks like this would really undermine their ability to govern, although they do still have the support to this point of European leaders and United Nations leaders.
Yeah, and this is the big question, whether the government of National Accord is going to remain the, or will it going forward continue to have the support of the United Nations, continue to have support of the Europeans, when, as time goes on, it looks like it's losing grounds as far as garnering support inside Libya. And yet we, even though the United States, France, Germany, they know this, they are pretty stubborn about this. I mean, this is their creation. This is their hope of stabilizing Libya. And you've got the Eastern government that refuses to submit, takes away their only real source of revenue, small as it would be. And I think the cards of the international community were shown this week when they did release a statement after this general took those terminals and said that Tripoli, or this UN brokered government in the West, they said that Tripoli is the sole steward of these resources, and added that Libya's oil belongs to Libyan people. Now, it's really interesting here that they would use that terminology when you think about the goal of an international group that claims to know what's best for the Libyan people, when the government that they've supported doesn't even have the support of the Libyan people. General Haftar, the guy that took over these terminals, would agree with that. Yes, Libya's oil does belong to Libyan people, and I am getting it for them.
Yeah, this really seems to be upping the ante. I mean, clearly Europe especially has quite a vested interest in trying to stabilize Libya, and has been committing more resources to that. And here they, like you said, they kind of picked their horse in the race. And for this to happen contrary to their wishes, it does make you wonder what the next step is going to be. What sort of muscle might Europe put behind trying to reverse what's happened here?
I don't think we believe that the Europeans are going to change their tune with this. They're going to be bullheaded with it and continue to support the government of National Accord, and that is going to be dangerous for the stability of Libya going forward. One of the best analysts of Libya is Jason Pack, and he wrote a piece about this takeover, and he said basically that it could, you know, spell doom for the Western-backed government of National Accord, considering that the Eastern government has got more power now, more people are supporting them, and they have at least the oil on their side. And then he writes, most importantly, to avoid inadvertently creating further chaos, the international community must ensure that this political solution is in place before engaging further militarily in Libya. He's saying, hey, if you want this to work out, you need to bring these heads together from East and West and figure this out before you start pumping your military into Libya. And what we expect is for them not to come together and work with the Eastern government, but to do exactly that, pump their military into Libya to support what really amounts to a puppet government for the Europeans that is going to give them a lot of control over Western Libya.
And ultimately, we talk so much about the alliance taking place between Iran and Libya, looked at from a prophetic standpoint. And so it does seem like the fact that this could become yet another battleground between what effectively is European and Iranian forces is something to keep our eyes on as well.
For sure. The movement of Iran into this equation further, I think, is definitely something to watch for going forward, because that's what the prophecy talks about. It talks about how the King of the South, Iranian-led radical Islam, is going to push at Europe, and Europe is going to respond. And a couple of the first places it seems that they're going to respond are Libya and Ethiopia, these two areas on the fringe of Iranian-backed Middle East. And what we're seeing right now is the beginning steps of Libya, of the Europeans moving in there to counter radical Islam's move in Libya.
Thank you, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The unrest in Libya is just one arena that is creating a massive problem for Europe, the immigration crisis. But really, it's part of a much larger problem that more and more Europeans are identifying as really a Muslim problem. Recent statements by a religious leader in Europe point to this. And to learn about these, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this really is a great example of what we talked about on this show on Wednesday, where we went back to the potential for Europe to develop a Christian identity. And we're starting to see more and more people talk about this. And so this week, one of the people that brought this up was Cardinal Christopher Schoenborn. He is the Archbishop of Vienna. He was a pupil of Pope Benedict. And he was talking on the 333rd anniversary of the Battle of Vienna. Now, this is one of these kind of great milestone battles in the history of Europe, one of the biggest ones ever when it comes to the history of the clash between the Catholic Church and Islam. The Islamic Ottoman Empire had been storming across, you know, hugely successful. They were now pushing up into Europe. And this was, again, one of those moments where people were asking, is Europe, is at least Eastern Europe or some of Central Europe, going to become Muslim now? And the Holy Roman Empire allied with Poland and a few others and came together and formed this Christian coalition. And they came and they fought the Ottoman Empire. They lifted the siege at the Battle of Vienna. And the rest, as they say, is history. The Ottoman Empire was contained. Europe did not become Muslim. So it's this hugely symbolic battle in Europe's history. And Cardinal Schoenborn was talking on this anniversary. And he said, will there now be a third attempt at an Islamic conquest of Europe? The first he's referring to was when Charles Martel stopped his Muslims coming up from Spain a few years before Charlemagne. And he says many Muslims want that and say that Europe is at an end. And he prayed at the end of that address, Lord, remember it is your people. And if we have strayed, if we have squandered the inheritance, do not abandon us. Do not abandon this Europe, which has produced so many saints. Do not abandon us because we have become lukewarm in our faith. So you have a very senior figure within the Catholic Church talking about this as a conflict, not between secular Europe and radical Islam, but between Christianity and Christian Europe and Islam in general.
Now, this is interesting coming from him. The Pope Francis recently stirred the ire of a lot of Catholics by making statements that were much softer against Islam, but he seems to have backed away from that somewhat. It seems like the church is kind of struggling to find a unified voice on this, but to have such a senior figure make these statements does seem significant.
That's right, and yes, and the Pope hasn't been anywhere close to as outspoken as this cardinal or as Pope Benedict was when he was Pope, but he has changed his tune a little. He talked about this week, to kill in the name of God is satanic, he said. And Christian Today reported that he's signaling that he's preparing to canonize or make a saint the priest who was murdered by ISIS terrorists. Mm. Now, that's usually a long, drawn-out process, making someone a saint. But if that happened, you know, that would be a major rallying cry and, I think, signal a stiffening of response from the Catholic Church. The other piece of news that I think is really interesting from this week comes from within Germany, where the Christian Social Union they demanded over the last week or so an Immigration Limitation Act, where they talked about setting a priority for immigrants from our Western Christian culture. And that's a quote from this law that they want. And that, I think, now you're seeing so you're seeing a similar kind of call to put things in terms of Christian versus Islam, not from a religious authority, but from a political party. Mm-hmm. And we have seen this, and we've talked about it on this program, coming from Central and Eastern Europe, from places like Poland or the Czech Republic. But now you've got a major player within Germany calling for the same thing. So I think it's really significant that you're having a big spread and a very rapid spread with these news just from the past week or so to paint this conflict now in terms of Christianity versus Islam. And that's reached a level that we haven't yet seen before.
Certainly a trend that we've been expecting for many years. Mm-hmm. The entrance of religion into this discussion and the provocation by Muslims to cause Europe to have to resort more to religion in, as a unifying force, like we were talking about on Wednesday. So very interesting to hear the statement from that cardinal, and something that we can expect to see continue. We appreciate that, Richard. We spoke in the first half about the changing state of the world in light of American weakness. And you definitely see significant changes taking place in Asia because of that development. One of America's strongest allies has been the Philippines, but that is changing rapidly. And to learn about a development that happened just this week, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the new president of the Philippines has signaled an abrupt departure from his nation's longstanding military reliance on the U.S. And now it really looks like he's looking to none other than Russia and China. On Tuesday of this week, he ordered his defense secretary to start seeking military gear from suppliers in Russia and China. The U.S. has always had a strong corner on the arms market in the Philippines, supplying about 75% of total weaponry. But now, after his order on Tuesday, it looks like that percentage will rapidly diminish. And Russia and China, for their parts, have already responded really eagerly to the Philippines, offering some soft loans that would make it very easy for them to buy a lot of weapons. And then on the same day, Duterte called for America to withdraw military advisors and personnel from Mindanao Island. Mindanao is a Muslim-majority part of the country, and Duterte said that as long as U.S. forces are there, it'll just kind of agitate the situation and prevent any efforts toward peace. So he wants the U.S. gone. And then apparently also on the same day, Tuesday was a big day for Duterte, he said that the Philippines would stop patrolling the South China Sea alongside the U.S. Navy in order to avoid upsetting Beijing. He said the Philippine military should instead focus on combating drugs and terrorism within its borders and not worry so much about what's happening in the South China Sea. So that's it's a major victory for China, who asserts full ownership over the South China Sea, basically, including much of the Philippines' territorial waters. We've spoken on the show before about the ruling last month, I think it was, the International Court there at The Hague ruled in favor of the Philippines and against China's claims. But apparently Duterte is choosing to kind of ignore the victory that The Hague gave to him and instead cede a lot of ground to China. So it's both a big victory for China and a pretty heavy blow for the United States, who has wanted to work with the Philippines and other nations to curb China's illegal activities there in the South China Sea and other parts of Asia. So I feel like all of this is very significant for the trumpet because it simultaneously points to two of the major trends that we're watching for. The first one being the decline of American power, with our historic allies kind of breaking with us and deciding not to trust us. That leaves us with a weaker will and just actually weaker. And then the second of those trends is the rise of the kings of the East, the Asian bloc led by Russia and China. The Philippines has always looked like quite an anomaly in Asia. It's a devoutly Catholic nation in a continent that's mostly Buddhist and Hindu, and in the case of China and Japan, just kind of an absence of religion really there. So in the post-war era, the Philippines has really looked like an anomaly. It's not only Catholic, but it's also had this intimate relationship with the U.S., not just in its military reliance, but also with its cultural leanings. So we've often looked at those Bible prophecies about the kings of the East and all of those nations in Asia kind of pooling their resources together, rallying behind Russia and China. And we've kind of wondered, how is this anomaly? How is the Philippines going to really fit into that group? But now, though, with Duterte in power, and with him abruptly shifting the Philippines away from that historic U.S. military reliance and toward China and Russia, it suddenly is much easier, I think, to see how the Philippines could be a part of that Kings of the East alliance.
Yeah, really a remarkable change for the Philippines. The if you haven't been there, it's hard to even really recognize just how close that kinship has been between the Philippines and the United States, how closely allied they were. So for this radical of a break to happen, it really is a significant change for that nation. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We have one last story in this segment. One of America's founding principles was religious liberty. This was actually what drew so many people to this country in its infancy. Whole congregations would come in order to enjoy this unique privilege that America offered. But we've come a long way since those days, and religious liberty is increasingly under attack. To tell us about the latest such attack, we're going to go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they had a new report released just this week, or on September 8th, by the U.S. Commission for Civil Rights. Now, this is a commission, it doesn't actually make laws, but it does give suggestions and reports that lawmakers take into consideration when they do make laws. But their newest report on religious liberty was trying to draw awareness that words like religious liberty or religious freedom are actually code words for things like racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. And they go through and they paint with a pretty broad brush in the report, not necessarily zooming in on specific cases, but just trying to tell lawmakers that, well, when you hear people talk about religious liberty, they're actually advocating Christian supremacy. And in our Trumpet Weekly, we have an article from The Atlantic that analyzes this a little more and saying that really it doesn't take too much analysts to see what they're talking about is like recent cases of like Christian bakers who have not wanted to bake or decorate wedding cakes for a homosexual wedding because homosexual weddings are against their religion. That would be something here where this report is saying that something like that is someone talking about religious liberty as a quote-unquote excuse to not bake a wedding cake for a homosexual couple. And the report does definitely gives the recommendation that says in many cases some of these religious liberty rights are going to have to give way before anti-discrimination laws. Another example The Atlantic article points out is like some of the Obamacare provisions saying that like Catholic universities or other Christian universities that don't believe in birth control still have to pay for birth control pills for their employees, even though it's against their religion. So they're not discriminating.
It really is remarkable to go back and look at America's history. There was certainly a lot of influence by Christianity, by biblically based religion in America's founding, and yet they insisted that the overall standard, Thomas Jefferson and the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom ensured that no one would be deprived of their ability to hold office or to go about their business because of their religion. And it did protect those who didn't have those beliefs. But what we have now is an aggressively secularist institution. And it is basically like the implementation of a secularist religion.
Right,
in a sense.
Because some of these laws, like the wedding cake example, I mean, there is no law saying that someone who's committed a homosexual act can't eat cake. They have full right to make a cake themselves or to even have a cake made for them by a baker who's fine with doing that. This law, so this isn't about making sure that someone who's committed homosexual acts has the right to eat a cake. This act is saying, it's like, no, this particular Christian denomination, we're going to use the power of the state to force you to bake a cake for that person so that you're not discriminating.
So, and it is interesting for them to be speaking specifically in terms of religious liberty and religious freedom and saying that this phraseology is code for discriminatory behavior. I mean, they really are undermining one of these pillar principles of America's founding.
Right. And actually, there's an article, a shorter article I'm working on right now. Hopefully, it'll go up next week on this trend within the military, too, where you've had like someone who's homosexual come into the military, specifically seek out a Christian chaplain and ask him for religious counseling on homosexuality. And then when they quote the Bible, go to the base commander and get him fired for harassing you.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty bold.
So it's definitely something that the government's able to enact that more in the military because it's a federal institution. But then there's also this Federal Civil Rights Commission. They're just making recommendations for state and local institutions, which some of them have been taking up. There's a case in Iowa recently, which was a state decision where they said that if your church services are open to the public, you're not allowed to preach against homosexuality because someone who's homosexual may wander into your church service and be offended.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like law in Iowa now, that if you want to preach that the Bible says homosexuality is wrong, you can't have an open door policy in your church.
Another trend that's certain to intensify. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. That's the weekly news report that we produce every week. And all the stories we talk about on this show are in The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Brent.
A historic agreement was finalized this week between the United States and Israel for the biggest military aid package in history. The new $38 billion arms deal will be for Israel to use that money over the next 10 years to invest in their own military under the stipulation this time, as opposed to previous years, that most of it it cannot be used to purchase Israeli wear, but it has to be used to purchase American. It's interesting. We've talked a lot about President Obama and the fact that he has a dislike for Israel. So why would he allow this huge military support or this military deal to go through, giving them lots of cash? And Rafael Aran, writing for the Times of Israel, he says that because Obama has given this much money, that this is going to open the way for a last final push for peace in the Middle East coming up in the final 5 months of President Obama's term. And hopefully he's going to leverage this money against the Israelis to work out a peace deal.
All right, now over to Richard.
The major push for a European army that we talked about last week continues. Over the weekend, the defense ministers of France and Germany put forward their proposal for an EU military union. And then on Wednesday, Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Commission president, gave his State of the Union address for the EU. He said the EU was in a crisis and that an EU military was one of his top priorities for fixing that crisis. That this is all pretty big news. I would have talked about it today, but right now, over this weekend, EU leaders are talking about this subject. So we could have even bigger news on this front next week.
Looking forward to that. We'll go now to Andrew.
Former British Prime Minister David Cameron decided to leave the UK House of Commons this week. On Monday, he announced his decision, saying that his position as a former prime minister was awkward within the House of Commons and deciding to leave politics entirely.
All right, now over to Jeremiah.
Yesterday, the Chinese and Russian navies launched 8 days of war games in the South China Sea. It's somewhat uncreatively called Joint Sea 2016. And the tasks will include defensive and rescue drills, anti-submarine exercises, and also the simulated seizure of enemy islands. So it's a big sign of the growing cooperation between these two armed forces.
All right, back over to Brent.
Iran's military might be getting ready to make some sweeping changes. This is the contention of Matthew McInnes, writing in the National Interest this week. He claims that now that the money is released, he's saying that the Iranian army is going to become more conventional because they'll have more funds to direct to that. And he believes this is going to end up with them getting more precision-guided missiles, development of long-range air power, as well as a blue water navy capability, something that we have been talking about with Iran inside the Persian Gulf.
And back to Richard.
Germany will send up to 650 soldiers on a new NATO military mission called Operation Sea Guardian. German media reported that the cabinet was discussing the proposals over the last week and that parliament should approve them by the end of the month. Sea Guardian is replacing Active Endeavour in monitoring and securing the Mediterranean Sea from terrorists and people traffickers. Germany was a part of Active Endeavour, and as Deutsche Welle notes, the deployment is regarded as part of a broader shift in Germany to expand its military role in Europe and NATO.
All right, and we'll finish with Andrew.
Well, you can believe me or not, but a new Gallup poll has revealed that only 1 in 3 Americans have even a moderate level of trust in the media these days. The rate was specifically low amongst Republicans, where only 14% trust the media, the lowest percentage in over 20 years.
All right. Well, I trust you, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. Tell us what you think of this program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Will Terrell. Success is 10% talent and 90% staying off the internet. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.